101.9 FM, www.cfrc.ca, Queen's University, Kingston, Ontario.
Hey everybody, this is Chris Jackson on CFRC, letting my love shine bright, 101.9 FM.
For 142 years, the Queen's Gaels have called Kingston home. The tricolor has become as synonymous with the city as the limestone upon which it was built. But that love, admiration, and respect comes with a powerful commitment. A pledge to protect this house. On Saturday, August 31st, the Queen's Gaels will host the McMaster Marauders for their home opener at Richardson Memorial Stadium. Kickoff is scheduled for 6 p.m. and CFRC's coverage will begin at 5:45.
This is Democracy Now!
The civil defense came to put out the fire, and the Israeli forces did not let them through. We broke down the bathroom window and got out. My wife's shoulder and arm was burned. Thank God it only came to that. They did not give us any prior warning or anything. I do not know why they treat us like this.
Israel's largest military operation, the occupied West Bank, in decades continues. At least 18 Palestinians have been killed. We'll go to Jenin, where Israeli forces have raided the city, but first to Gaza, where at least 68 Palestinians have been killed in the last 24 hours in Israel's continuing assault. Then Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky rules out any ceasefire as Russia continues its largest aerial assault since the invasion.
There can be no compromises with Putin. Dialogue today is in principle empty and meaningless because he does not want to end the war diplomatically. He does not want it. He pretends to be ready for a diplomatic way, but under the condition of giving him 30% of our land.
We'll also look at the International Atomic Energy Agency's warnings of a nuclear catastrophe at the aging Russian Kursk nuclear plant. Zaporizhia in Ukraine is also vulnerable. And in Afghanistan, the Taliban approves a law banning women from speaking in public.
I think this new law of the Taliban further restricts the rights and freedom of women and completely erase them from the society. Even silence their voice, and they cannot get out of the house without male member of their family.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Gaza, Israeli attacks have killed at least 68 Palestinians and wounded 77 others over the past 24 hours. An attack just hours ago on displaced people in Khan Yunis killed or injured more than a dozen people, mostly women and children. Another attack on Rafah killed at least seven Palestinians. The mother of Gaza's first confirmed polio patient, Abdulrahman Abuljidian, a nearly one-year-old boy who is now paralyzed, is speaking out and pleading for medical treatment. This is Naveen Abuljidian.
I was shocked that my son got this disease amidst the war and the closure of border crossings. Under these conditions and lack of medicine for him, it's a shock. Would he remain like this? For how long? Is there a treatment for him? Is there someone to treat him? I don't know what to do. I took him to the hospital. They told me that my son has polio and they cannot treat him. They cannot do anything for him. He is my only baby boy. It's his right to travel and be treated. It's his right to walk, run, and move like before. It's his right to get the proper treatment, travel, get out, and get his chance in life.
The World Food Program has suspended all staff movement across Gaza after Israeli soldiers opened fire on one of its vehicles, hitting it 10 times. The vehicle was clearly marked as belonging to the United Nations and was part of a convoy that the UN had coordinated with the Israeli military. This is UN spokesperson Stefan Dujarric.
I think after this conflict is over, and we hope it's over much sooner than later, there will need to be accountability. There will be boards of inquiry to look at the destruction of UN property, the death of UN personnel, notably our security colleague.
The UN Security Council is meeting today to discuss the humanitarian crisis and the delivery of aid in Gaza. Israel's continuing its largest raids on the occupied West Bank in decades. Overnight, the Palestinian death toll rose to at least 18 as Israeli forces pushed into Jenin, Tul Karam, and the Farah refugee camp near Tabas with armored vehicles, bulldozers, fighter jets, and drones. More than 30 people have been injured since Israel launched the raids Wednesday. The Palestinian Islamic Jihad confirmed the commander of its armed wing was killed in the Nur Shams camp. We'll go to guests in Gaza and Jenin for more after headlines. The European Union's foreign policy chief, Josep Borrell, warned that Israel's incursion in the West Bank must not be, quote, the premise of a war extension from Gaza, unquote, amidst fears Israel's preparing to annihilate another Palestinian territory. Borrell said he asked European Union members about possible sanctions on Israeli ministers who've called for the destruction of the West Bank and the Palestinian people.
Some Israeli ministers has been launching hate messages, unacceptable hate messages against the Palestinians, and proposing things that goes clearly against international law and is an incitation to commit war crimes.
Ireland accused Israel of deliberately targeting civilians and said it supported EU sanctions. This comes after Israel's foreign minister, Israel Katz, wrote of the West Bank invasion, quote, "We need to deal with the threat exactly as we deal with terror infrastructure in Gaza. This is a war for everything, and we must win it." Meanwhile, Egypt has rejected any Israeli presence along its border with Gaza, including the Rafah border crossing and the Philadelphia corridor. Israel's military presence in the Philadelphia corridor has become a point of contention in ceasefire talks, which Cairo has been hosting. In other related news, Namibia has blocked a vessel suspected of carrying explosive weapons to Israel from docking at its ports. Rights groups had warned Namibian officials that allowing the vessel to dock could implicate Namibia in potential human rights violations. The Biden administration's rebuffed the prospect of resuming nuclear talks with Iran after Tehran expressed its willingness to return to the negotiating table. Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, gave Iran's new president, the reformist Masoud Pezeshkian, the okay on Tuesday to relaunch talks with Washington. But a U.S. State Department spokesperson told reporters shortly after the news, quote, "We are far away from anything like that right now," unquote. A Hong Kong court has convicted two editors of a pro-democracy newspaper of sedition. The landmark verdict against journalists with the Stand newspaper was swiftly blasted by press freedom groups. Reporters Without Borders called on Hong Kong authorities to, quote, stop its nefarious campaign against press freedom, unquote. The Stand was one of the last pro-democracy publications in Hong Kong before it was raided by police and forced to shut down in 2021 amidst Beijing's mounting crackdown on Hong Kong's autonomy. In Beijing, U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan met with Chinese President Xi Jinping today, capping off a rare 3 days of talks between a Biden administration official and Chinese leaders. The U.S. and China have agreed to hold more military talks and said a call between President Biden and Xi Jinping will be planned in the coming weeks. A top Chinese military officer also asked Jake Sullivan during a meeting to end U.S. quote-unquote collusion with Taiwan, over which China claims sovereignty. Honduras has vowed to end its extradition treaty with the United States after the U.S. ambassador denounced Honduran officials and implied they were working with drug traffickers. The U.S. accusation came after Honduran Defense Minister Jose Manuel Zelaya met with his Venezuelan counterpart, Vladimir Petrino, who was indicted by the U.S. on drug trafficking charges in 2020. This is Honduran Foreign Minister Enrique Reina.
International relations must be based in mutual respect, in dialogue, and not meddling and trying to impose policies, no matter the other state's positions, based on its interests. They cannot force another country to take the positions they want and must respect Honduras's stance.
The U.S. has long supported narco-traffickers in Honduras, most famously former President Juan Orlando Hernandez, who received unconditional U.S. backing during his rule, but was extradited in 2022 to the United States and in June of this year sentenced to 45 years by a U.S. court. In Texas, Governor Greg Abbott said Monday his state has removed more than a million people from the voter rolls since the 2020 election. About half of those people who've died or moved out of Texas. The remainder include hundreds of thousands who failed to update voter registration information after changing addresses. About 6,000 were stripped of their right to vote due to a felony conviction. Another 6,500 people were moved from the voter rolls after they were labeled non-citizens. A coalition of voting rights groups, including the Texas Civil Rights Project and the ACLU, warned in a letter to election officials, quote, Texas may be engaging anew in unlawful purges under the guise of list maintenance, unquote. The groups also say Republican elections officials purge voter rolls within 90 days of an election, a violation of federal law. And in labor news, unionized workers at Cornell University celebrated reaching a tentative agreement with the Ivy League school after less than 2 weeks on strike. The deal, which will benefit maintenance and dining room staff, gardeners and custodians, includes historic pay increases of up to 25%, cost of living adjustments, and ending a two-tier wage system. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
And I'm Nermeen Sheikh. Welcome to our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world. In Gaza, at least 68 Palestinians have been killed and 77 wounded in the last 24 hours, according to the Gaza Health Ministry. Nearly 11 months into Israel's war on Gaza, the toll now stands at more than 40,600 Palestinians killed and nearly 94,000 wounded, though the true casualty figures are expected to be much higher, with thousands unaccounted for. As Israel's daily bombardment continues, the humanitarian crisis is only deepening. The World Food Program has announced it's pausing the movement of all staff in Gaza until further notice after Israeli forces shot at one of its clearly marked vehicles as it was moving toward an Israeli military checkpoint. The UN Food Agency said the vehicle was shot despite receiving multiple clearances by Israeli authorities to approach. The UN Food Agency said the incident was a, quote, stark reminder of the rapidly and ever-shrinking humanitarian space in the Gaza Strip. This comes just 2 days after the UN's humanitarian efforts in Gaza virtually ground to a halt due to new Israeli evacuation orders that forced the shutdown of the main UN operations center in Deir al-Balah. The UN's main humanitarian aid hub, with warehouses and accommodation for staff, had already been relocated once before in early May, following Israel's ground invasion of Rafah in southern Gaza. The new hub was set up in Deir al-Balah in central Gaza, but an evacuation order by the Israeli military on Sunday also included the new headquarters. Israel has issued several evacuation orders across Gaza over the past week, displacing a quarter of a million people in Deir al-Balah alone. The new orders also forced many families and patients to leave Al-Aqsa Hospital, the main medical facility in Deir al-Balah, where tens of thousands of residents and wounded were seeking shelter.
We go now to Gaza, to just outside the Al-Aqsa Hospital, where we're joined by journalist Akram Al-Sattari. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Akram. If you can explain the situation right now, the attention now is on the West Bank, but in the last 24 hours alone, 68 Palestinians have been killed in Gaza alone, with more than that injured.
Yeah. Good morning to you, Amy, and to all viewers. Indeed, the situation in Gaza is ever escalating. The situation in the West Bank is marking a new beginning, where Israeli occupation forces are using the very same tactics of destruction and devastation, and also besieging the hospitals and the other infrastructure for the sake of, just as they said, for the sake of preventing the movement of the armed people. But indeed, that brings more devastation to the infrastructure and more devastation to the civilian population. In the Gaza Strip, 68 Palestinians were killed in the last 24 hours. Around 21 Palestinians are killed since the morning as of today. And the number of Palestinians who are injured is also increasing. The number of military operations that has an aim, that have an aim of destroying residential blocks is increasing. The bombardment that is resulting from the ongoing operation destroying the residential blocks in Rafah area, in Khan Yunis area, in Deir el-Balah in Gaza central area, Al-Burj, and also in Al-Zaytun area is also heard from all different parts of the Gaza Strip. Continuous military operations, continuous devastation, continuous targeting, and increased number of Palestinians affected by those ongoing operations, either by being killed or being injured, or by becoming displaced because of the new evacuation orders that were given to the Palestinians to move them from the humanitarian zone, to move them to the humanitarian zone that is also ever shrinking.
Akram, if you could describe the scale of these evacuation orders. Over 88.5% of Gaza is under evacuation orders. What's the impact of these evacuation orders on people who are in Gaza?
For you to better understand the situation, people are asked to move to areas that have no infrastructure whatsoever, that have no regular water supplies, that have no regular even garbage collection services, with the municipal services coming to a full halt. So you would be walking down the streets, seeing tents erected on the sides of the road, seeing tents erected on the open areas, no infrastructure, no even sewage, no water supplies, no electricity, no hygiene, and the people are living there. And all of the sudden, they are asked to move from the very same area that is very lacking to another area to start removing the tents and building the tents in some other area. People are asked to move to an area of around 11% of the Gaza Strip, to be more precise. And in those areas that are called the humanitarian zone, there is nothing that have to do or has to do with the humanitarian need. The humanitarian needs are not met, and people are exposed and vulnerable to extremely increasing risk of the bombardment. In those areas, people were erecting their tents, and they ended up being targeted and killed in those tents. In Al-Nus area in Khan Yunis, around 100 Palestinians were killed when the Israeli occupation forces targeted the whole area and then claimed to have managed to assassinate Mohammed al-Dayf, who is the commander general of Hamas military wing. People are, even when they're moving to a humanitarian zone, they are not receiving humanitarian services. The UN agencies and the other international agencies are also facing increasingly difficult situation because of the movement restrictions that have been taking place, because of the fact that they have always to redefine and replan for the sake of making sure that they can access the people and they can also make sure that their teams are safe. Their teams are not safe, the journalists are not safe, the medical teams are not safe, the international teams are not safe. And about every category, there is a list of incidents and of deaths and of injuries and of the destruction of the properties and the vehicles also when they were targeted by the Israeli occupation forces. So the bottom line, that the situation is overall unsafe, and the Israeli ongoing ground operations and aerial operations and the continuous targeting, including quadcopters and artillery fire and the F-16 and all the other kinds of the weapons in their arsenal, is making things more difficult for the Palestinians and making life in Gaza more unlivable.
Akram, under these conditions, if you could talk about the diseases that are so rapidly spreading in Gaza, including most recently polio.
Yeah. yes, some statements were made, and at least one case of polio virus was already confirmed in Gaza for a child who's 11 months old, and the risk of the outbreak of that disease, given the very severe limitations on the movement of the international staff and also of the local staff, and also the impact of the ongoing operations on the primary health care centers, that most of them are not functional anymore because of the bombardment. There were some also alarming percentages about the hepatitis A that has been widespread in the Gaza Strip, and around 1 million Gazans have already been infected with this hepatitis A that is extremely contagious, and that is can be transmitted also through touching. The water is polluted, the food is polluted, no hygienic conditions, and the result of that is very big risks for the public health of the people in Gaza. And the concerns have already been voiced by the UNRWA, by other UN agencies such as the UNFPA, the UN Women Program, where women, children, and elderly people are bearing the brunt of that very lacking situation and of that ongoing bombardment. So people at large are affected by that. They're affected also by some digestive issues because of the quality of the water and the quality of the food, and lacking to hygienic situation for also cooking the food. So overall, the situation is extremely risky and dangerous for all different categories of the Palestinian population. And if you need a soup in Gaza, if you need washing soap, or if you need even bleach to wash the clothes, you will not find it in Gaza. You will not find it in Gaza Central Area, in Khan Yunis, in Rafah, or even in Gaza City. People are suffering, and people are denied the access to the very, very basic things that have to do with their life. They cannot clean themselves, they cannot clean their clothes, they cannot clean their houses or their tents, and they are left to face the exacerbating humanitarian crisis, and they are left to face those increasingly acute humanitarian needs without any help extended to them, because according to some of the international organizations, the Israeli occupation is not allowing the hygienic stuff into the Gaza Strip, and that exacerbates the problem of the Gazans.
Akram, we only have a minute to go. We do not take for granted that we're even able to speak to you in Deir al-Balah, in Gaza. Deir al-Balah itself has been under attack. 90% of Palestinians have been displaced at least once. How do you keep yourself and your own family safe?
Well, I'm one of the Palestinians who have been displaced. I've been displaced for around 12 times. It is something that makes you feel unsafe. This is something that makes you feel detached from your original habitat. This is something that makes you feel vulnerable. This is something that makes you fear an imminent death that is coming to you, something that I have seen with my eyes. I saw the bombardment. I saw the people getting injured. I saw the destruction of the homes of the people, and I saw people frantically trying to grab anything and run for the sake of just starting a new life anywhere else where they are in a situation that is extremely lacking. No one is promised tomorrow in Gaza. And I will conclude by quoting the UNRWA Commissioner General, who said, no one safe, no place safe. And that will still continue and remain like that if no solution reached, if no agreement concluded between all the parties. The situation is extremely catastrophic. I think sometimes I had the chance of being in Western countries. I had the chance of being in African countries, in China. I tell you, what we are living is inconceivable in the sense of everything that has to do with a normal life. We are extremely sure that we might not live for the next second, not for the next minute, but we still have to endure that, and we still have to chase life despite death, uncertainty, and destruction.
Akram al-Sathari, be safe. Thank you so much for being with us. Gaza-based journalist joining us from outside the Al-Aqsa Hospital in Deir al-Balah in central Gaza. We usually break at this point, but because we're going to the occupied West Bank, to Jenin, which is under siege, we don't want to risk losing our next guest. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheh.
We turn now from Gaza to the occupied West Bank, where Israel has launched its largest military operation in over two decades, raiding four cities and refugee camps in the north simultaneously with hundreds of soldiers backed by armored vehicles, bulldozers, fighter jets, and drones. At least 18 Palestinians have been killed and 30 wounded. On Wednesday, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres called on Israel to immediately end its military operation and strongly condemned the loss of lives, including that of children. Meanwhile, three leading Palestinian human rights groups issued a joint statement warning, quote, of even more escalated violence in the West Bank with the employment of tactics that mirror those used in Israel's genocidal campaign in Gaza, particularly attacks on hospitals and healthcare facilities, and the use of excessive and indiscriminate force.
In Jenin, Israeli forces have surrounded the city, blocking exit and entry points and access to hospitals and ripping up infrastructure in the Jenin refugee camp. Jenin's been the target of frequent raids by Israeli forces, but this latest military operation is the largest since the Second Intifada 2 decades ago, when Jenin witnessed some of the worst violence of that period after Israeli forces invaded it in 2002, laid siege to the refugee camp, killing dozens of civilians, destroying hundreds of homes, leaving a quarter of the population homeless. We go now to Jenin, where we're joined by Ahmed Tabassi, artistic director at the Freedom Theater in the Jenin refugee camp. Welcome to Democracy Now! Ahmed, describe the scene in Jenin right now.
Thank you, Amy, for having me. I mean, the scene, it's the same again and again, but as I said before, the Israelis keeping surprising us, even the way they do the invasions. To be honest, I am calling my sisters around, some friends, and they are very scared. We all of us very scared. We know there is something different in this invasion. The way they start the invasion, the way they doing it now, it's really scary. People don't know what's going to happen. It looks like it's going to be a bit more longer invasion than others. We are surprised of the number of the soldiers, the vehicles that keep coming to the city. The camp now having sometime electricity, sometime not. For sure, the internet is not there. We try to use the 3Gs and not totally always good. But yeah, it's a fear atmosphere where everybody is waiting. And you know, the scenes from Gaza, what happened to Gaza, the people in the camp are really afraid that gonna happen to them, because it's obvious the Israelis punishing the people, punishing the civilians. In the camp, all camp is surrounded with the army. All the entrances are closed. They already bulldozed all the streets, all the alleyways in the camp. And even the bulldozing is really deep. That means no cars, no ambulances can go inside. Many people try to evacuate the camp, but for sure it's very dangerous, because if you are a man above 15 or 14, you could be shot if you are moving or you try to sneaking out from the camp. Only maybe a kids or some women, if they are courage enough to leave, to know what's going on outside the house, to leave the camp, but no one allowed is to move. People are afraid of having no food now for 1 week, because, you know, they didn't prepare themselves for the invasion. They don't know which kind of the invasion is this. And, you know, the Israelis do not announce what they're going to do exactly. So many people are really afraid for the kids, they having no food. So, yes, you hear the drones very close, the vehicles all around, the booming by time to time. It's again the scene repeating itself again and again. And we don't know, like, what is the end, how long, what we should do. And it's obviously the Israelis want to tell the communities, the civilians of these areas, you have only two choices. You die here or you leave or displace to other country. And that's what is we still waiting what's going to happen in the next days.
So, Ahmed, if you could put this latest military operation in the context of the ongoing assault on Gaza on the one hand, and also the situation that's been developing in the West Bank, both with the increasing violence over the last 10 months since the Israeli assault on Gaza, as well as the exponential increase in the number of Israeli settlements there.
Yes, I mean, also at the same time, I hope American language and American, let's say, journalism start using the definition in a right way. It is not violence. It's a genocide from the Israeli army against the Palestinian people. It's not a conflict. It's a genocide, a war, ethnic cleansing from the Israeli military to the Palestinian civilians. And yes, it's to be honest, from 100,000 of settlers to 850,000 in West Bank. West Bank is not anymore a West Bank. It's a little fragment from Palestinian communities living there and there. And all the connection, all the network, the streets, all controlled by the settlers. I promise you, I experienced a death threat. One time I went, I was trying to go back from Ramallah to Jenin. It's not even late, it's the evening. And suddenly we find ourselves surrounded by settlers who really clearly want to kill you. And we, in the last second, we just ran with the car. And if we just stopped, they are ready to kill you. They are attacking everywhere. They are putting fire in the houses of the people. They're shooting now. They have guns, officially permitted guns from the Israeli government being given to the settlers to shoot Palestinians in very easy cold blood. So we're not facing only army, we're facing a crazy settlers, groups of crazy people who just want to kill more and more. And the idea is clear. They want to empty West Bank from Palestinians. Guys, what is happening in Gaza? What is happening in West Bank? We say it again and again. This was planned from 8 years, and the Israelis have the time to work on it slowly to displace Palestinians in Palestine. They want Palestine empty from Palestinians, and that's the only plan. And they will not relax. They will not stop until this happened, or inshallah, it will be victory for Palestinians and they will get defeated.
Ahmed Tabassi, there have been more than 10,000 Palestinians on the West Bank arrested since October 7th. We have brought out reports from CNN to Human Rights Watch to Haaretz to Admir of prisoners who haven't been charged, being sexually abused, being tortured. I'm wondering if you can talk about the effect of this level of imprisonment, and particularly this past December, the Israeli forces raided the offices of your theater, of the Jenin Freedom Theater. Producer Mustafa Shetha was detained and sentenced to 6 months. Have you heard from him? Has he seen a lawyer? Has he been accused?
Exactly. That's what I'm talking about, Emmy. I had an interview with your program in December, last December, and it's the same and even more crazy. Mustafa still in prison, no information, not allowed even for lawyers to visit or have any information. As we said before, even kids in the Freedom Theater being shot where they were blamed. So for me, it's like is really American people, American governments know what is going on? Are they really following? We have been saying this years and years, again and again, tons of report, United Nations, tons of report. And what is next? We still, that's why Israelis going on in there. That's why they're getting, and I'm sure the Israelis could not do this if they do not have the green light from the U.S. government. I am saying from your window, from your program, I'm calling to the American people, to the American artists, to the American activists, to the American people, please, you are the one who have to move now and stop this craziness. You have to stop supporting sending bombs to Israel. Enough military support. This military support goes for killing artists, children, destroying theaters, killing people, killing women. They do nothing more than this. And the peace that Israel is looking for is not to have a peace in Palestine. It's to control all the world. It's to occupy the whole Middle East and use it for the political situation that U.S. try to fight China and Iran and Russia in Palestine. We need to do something. It's not only Palestinian left alone to deal with the Israeli occupation that is defending West and Europe. U.S., it's really in a very difficult situation. If the U.S. do not follow the time and do something before this will be out of time, I think American people have to explain to the next generation. American people have to explain to the new generation in America what they did to the Palestinians, what they did to save and to finish this genocide and war. Guys, you will have a big responsibility in the future to define what happened to the Palestinians from the American support to the Israeli military terrorism people.
Ahmed Tabassi, we want to thank you for being with us, artistic director at the Freedom Theater in Jenin refugee camp, speaking to us from Jenin. Next up, in Afghanistan, the Taliban approves a law banning women from speaking in public. Stay with us.
Del que dispara de lejos, del que apretó el botón rojo y no se atrevió a mirarme a los ojos, bajo los escombros se reescribieron las historias que no se han contado, están los libros que nunca leyeron, los soldados que nos bombardearon.
Los Escombros, Under the Rubble, by Residente and Amal Mercus. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
In Afghanistan, the Taliban has approved a wide-ranging law that forces women to completely cover their bodies, including their faces, and remain silent in public. The law will be enforced by the morality police, who work under the Ministry for the Propagation of Virtue and the Prevention of Vice. The law codifies many rules that have been in place since the Taliban returned to power 3 years ago. The law has been widely condemned. This is Ravina Shamdasani, spokesperson for the Office of the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights.
These are partners who are being completely silenced, and they're attempting to render them into shadows. Their voices are no longer permissible. Education is no longer permissible. You cannot even see their faces. This needs to stop, and we need to continue talking about it. We need to continue advocating for it and putting pressure on the authorities to listen.
Afghan women have been defying the Taliban's edicts in videos posted on social media or shared with human rights groups. This woman living inside Afghanistan concealed her identity as she recorded herself singing, "You have silenced my voice until further notice. You have imprisoned me in my home for the crime of being a woman."
مرا با جرم زن بودن اسیر خانه ام کردی چه کس باید دهد اکنون غذای کون.
For more, we're joined by Seema Samar, an Afghan human rights advocate and medical doctor. She was chairperson of the Afghanistan Independent Human Rights Commission from 2002 to 2019. She also briefly served as Minister of Women's Affairs in the Afghan interim government in 2002. In 2012, she was awarded the Right Livelihood Award in recognition of her work on women's rights. She's now a visiting scholar at Tufts University. Her memoir, published earlier this year, titled Outspoken: My Fight for Freedom and Human Rights in Afghanistan. Seema Samar, welcome back to Democracy Now! How sad, ironic, that your book is called Outspoken, when the Taliban have now said women cannot speak in public. Can you respond exactly what this law is and what it means?
Thank you so much, Amy. It's nice to be in your show. Thank you for having me here. Yes, I think this law further restricts all the rights that the woman had. They already put a lot of restriction on women's rights. They were not able to go get education. They were not able to work outside of the house. They were not able to travel alone without male mahram. They were not able to walk with open faces. But I mean, still the Afghan women were resisting on those. But this law further restricts the rights and freedom of all the people, but particularly the women. They cannot even raise their voice, even if they recite Quran. You cannot see such a law in any other regime in this planet. So I think it is the full isolation, systematic erase of women from public life. And as we call it, it's gender apartheid. I think they, with this law, they completed gender apartheid. I don't know why the people around us, the international community, do not see this. And it's also was a reaction to the endorsement of the Taliban in Doha 3. Because if you remember, Doha 3 was the meeting earlier, 6 weeks ago, in Doha with the Taliban. In a price that they brought the Taliban spokesperson and representative in Doha to meet with all the representatives of the international communities, and the United Nations organized this, and they refused to add the civil society and women's group to the main meeting. After a lot of pressure, we just put on the UN. They said, okay, at the end of the actual meeting, they will see some people from civil society. So this was a policy trying to normalize the Taliban. So this law is a reaction and an answer to the normalization of the United Nations and some other countries who tries to say that the Taliban are the reality of Afghanistan. And I would say, yes, the Taliban are the reality of Afghanistan, but millions and millions of people and women in Afghanistan is also reality. And this is a crime against humanity. It is gender apartheid. You don't have any other name. I'm sorry, I heard the news about the Middle East. What I see, it's the continuation of culture of impunity everywhere.
Dr. Samad, if you could also just comment, you mentioned gender apartheid, which is, of course, what many are saying, the Taliban have created a state of gender apartheid in Afghanistan. But what's your sense of how other people, ordinary Afghans, are responding to these measures? A recent survey found that almost 70% want women's rights to be a central, important feature of the focus of the government. If you could respond.
Yeah, actually, they have a regime of fear and oppression. They treat people with the gunpoint. That's why they're so violent, and nobody has a law and nobody is accountable. So that's why the people are not getting out of the house or protesting against this. I keep saying that it is not the problem of the woman, actually, in Afghanistan. It is the problem of every household. What the people could say and do, I think they have to stand more strongly and use their civil rights and start protesting against this inhuman, un-Islamic, and all, against all the international law and principles, and against all the obligation of Afghanistan towards all these conventions of human rights, and the violation, clear violation of Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Because practically, their voice cannot be heard by any man who is not related, maybe including the in-laws. I mean, it's a new style of slavery, in my view.
Sima Samar, if you can explain, I just want to say you were head of the Ministry of Women's Affairs very briefly. The Ministry for Women has now been changed into the Ministry for the Propagation of Virtue and Prevention of Vice. The new law, the new decree includes women must veil themselves in front of all men, even in front of non-Muslim women. It also permits brutal physical punishment, beating, intimidation, imprisonment without due process. Where do you see this all going right now?
I think they want to show that their actual opinion, because there were some people advocating for the Taliban that they are changed. They learned from their past mistakes. But I think it is really the responsibility, not only of the Afghan people. Of course, we have more responsibility than the others, to raise awareness about the situation in Afghanistan and to make it serious, to look serious. I think it's not only the problem in Afghanistan, it's going to spread in the other countries, particularly on the regional countries. We already see signs of this kind of behavior and empowerment of patriarchy in the region. So,
Who is financially backing the Taliban?
Unfortunately, everybody, because they get some money. This is, I don't know the exact number or amount. They're getting money from different intelligence services claiming that they are fighting against Daesh. And every week, there is $40 million going to Afghanistan in order to keep the
claiming that they're fighting against ISIS, you mean?
Yes, yes. And so that is really, and they also have contract and get a lot of money from the mining in Afghanistan, and they put different kind of taxes on people. Even the tax is not really has a rule. The inspector police or the Sharia inspector, what they call it, the Muftasid, they call it, they have the right to punish the people and take as much as they have to pay. Mm.
Well,
so the shopkeeper, the people who, the farmers, it's not, unfortunately, the environment is too bad, and the people doesn't have a lot of income from their farming.
Well, see, they have to. We have to leave it there, but we thank you so much for being with us. And, of course, we'll continue to follow this issue. Sima Samar, Afghan human rights advocate, medical doctor, chair of the Afghanistan Independent Human Rights Commission from 2002 to 2019, briefly served as Minister of Women's Affairs in the interim government of Afghanistan in 2002, was awarded the Right Livelihood Award for recognition of her work with women's rights now at Tufts University. Her memoir is called Outspoken, My Fight for Freedom and Human Rights in Afghanistan. Next up, Russia continues its largest aerial assault since the invasion as Ukrainian forces push deeper into Russia. We'll be back in 30 seconds. در گذرگاه آتش در کنار آزادی گلش گفته خواهد شد گلش گفته خواهد شد یک بهار آزادی من سرود خواهم خواند بار بار آزادی بار women singing in protest of the Taliban's newly approved law that forces women to completely cover their bodies, including their faces, and remain silent in public. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
We turn now to the war in Ukraine as Russia continues its largest aerial assault since invaded the country in 2022. This week, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said he hoped to present President Joe Biden with a plan for victory when he visits the United States for the UN General Assembly next month, but he's ruled out any immediate ceasefire with Russia. The Kremlin has dismissed the plan. Meanwhile, as Ukrainian forces press their counteroffensive deeper into Russia, the head of the International Atomic Energy Agency toured Russia's Kursk nuclear facility Tuesday. IAEA chief Rafael Grossi warned of the heightened risk of a nuclear catastrophe and said the aging Soviet-era nuclear plant's reactors are not protected by containment domes often found in modern facilities, making them more vulnerable in an attack.
For more, we're joined by two guests. In Berlin, Vladimir Slivyak is with us, co-chair of the Russian environmental organization EcoDefense. He won the 2021 Right Livelihood Award, the Alternative Nobel, for defending the environment and mobilizing grassroots opposition to Russia's coal and nuclear industries. And in Washington, D.C., Matt Duss is with us, executive vice president of the Center for International Policy, former foreign policy advisor to Senator Bernie Sanders. We welcome you both back to Democracy Now! I want to begin with Vladimir Slivyak. This extreme situation at the Kursk nuclear plant, the head of the IAEA has said that it is an old plant that doesn't have much of the safety mechanisms. Can you explain what's happening there? That's in Russia. It's been invaded by Ukraine in response to Russia's invasion of Ukraine, and also what's happening with Zaporizhia, which is in Ukraine, but it's occupied by Russia right now, and it's the largest nuclear power plant in Europe. Vladimir.
Hi, Amy. Thank you very much for having me on the show. So the situation near Kursk nuclear plant is getting worse and worse. Like basically every day, there is fighting between Russian and Ukrainian army. It was officially said it was in a few kilometers from a nuclear power plant. And today, Russian army already said that Ukrainians been trying to get into the city that is next to a nuclear power plant where the workers from the plant are living. And it's true that it's very old reactors. It's very similar to the one that exploded back in 1986 in Chernobyl, causing the largest nuclear accident in humankind history. And right now, situation, well, you can call it worst of the worst, for the reason that those are very old reactors. It's not protected, but containment. For example, Zaporizhia nuclear power plant in Ukraine, it's more protected. I mean, the reactors itself. In Kursk, reactors are not protected, and basically any big rocket, missile, or the bomb dropped on a reactor itself may lead to a very big nuclear accident. I wouldn't say it's going to be second Chernobyl, but it could be very, very big with a radioactive release approaching a few countries that are close to Russia.
Matt Duss, if you could respond to what Zelensky hopes to do, meeting with Biden when he comes to the U.S. next month, also hoping to meet with Trump and Kamala Harris.
Well, I think what he wants to do with Biden is to continue to increase the level of support, the quality of armament that the United States has been providing since the beginning of this war in February 2022. President Biden, in my view, has taken a fairly restrained approach to the level and quality of support that he's given to the Ukrainian military, steadily increasing that as the Ukrainian military shows that it's capable of using those arms productively. I think there's going to be some tension here because I think, again, President Biden has been pretty cautious and been criticized, including by some voices in Washington, D.C., about being too cautious about the possibility of an escalation. Certainly, no one wants to see a nuclear escalation, which would be catastrophic. But there is some, I think, difference of opinion about the utility right now of Ukraine's incursion into Russia, although I think many are impressed with what they've been able to achieve after 2 years of a solely defensive war.
Matt, if you can talk more about what has taken place, this huge change in the last weeks with Ukraine invading Russia, not clear how Putin will respond and how he's responded so far, and Zelensky saying at this point he's not interested in any discussion of a ceasefire or any kind of peace deal.
Right. Well, I think what we've seen over the past months before this incursion was Ukraine being a bit more aggressive in the way it was striking sites inside Russia, specifically sites that were used to launch rocket and drone attacks inside Ukraine. They were restrained from doing that for a long time by their U.S. And European partners out of escalation concerns. Once again, I think reasonable escalation concerns given the nuclear aspect here. But I think they showed that those escalation concerns may have been slightly overblown given Russia's relatively muted response to those attacks. And once again, I think we should note that attacking sites being used to launch missiles, rockets, and drones into Ukraine is a pretty legitimate tactic. But what we've seen just over the past week is, you know, actual U.S., Ukrainian military forces invading into Russia. The first time, I believe, since World War II that Russia's territory has been invaded by a foreign army. And I think part of the approach here is, again, to kind of turn the tables and show that Russia is not immune to these incursions. It's certainly a propaganda loss for President Vladimir Putin, though it's hard to say what Russians are actually seeing given the almost complete control that the Russian government has over what Russians are allowed to see in their media. But I do think just taking the initiative, as we saw about a year and a half ago in the first counteroffensive, I think that's one benefit of this, is for just Ukraine to show that it is not simply on its back foot and defending. It is now taking the initiative and taking the fight into Russia.
Vladimir, if you could speak about the Rosatom State Corporation, which is the Russian state corporation focused on nuclear energy, and its role in the occupation of Zaporizhia, Russia having replaced France now as the world's leading player in international nuclear power plant production.
Well, first of all, it's not just a nuclear corporation. It's a military organization. In fact, it's part of a Russian government. And it's in charge of a nuclear weapon and so-called civil nuclear power in Russia. But it's also being used by Vladimir Putin as an instrument of geopolitical fight around the world. Russia's going around to different developing countries, proposing them to build new nuclear power plants of Russian design, even giving them loans, because most of the developing countries cannot pay such big sums of money, because, one Russian nuclear power plant with, let's say, two reactors in it would cost over $10 billion of American dollars, and not many developing countries can afford it. So Russians would just loan this money to other countries, and in exchange they get, basically economic control and some sort of political control over those countries, because once you sign up with a Russian Rosatom to build reactor in your country, you get into dependence. It's dependence on Russian engineers, Russian technologies, supplying of Russian fuel, nuclear fuel, and also when the nuclear plant will go offline because it's old, you will be dependent on decommissioning technology, which is also coming from Russia. And we're talking about roughly 100 years or even 120 years, No nuclear power expansion that Rosatom is doing around the world under order of Vladimir Putin. It's expansion because Vladimir Putin wants more control over developing world. It wants to use developing world in his, opposition to the West, I would say.
And we also have to say that the Kursk nuclear power plant is similar to the Chernobyl nuclear power plant, which melted down in 1986. Matt, Dust, before we go, at the Democratic National Convention, we bumped into you. We were covering the uncommitted sit-in that took place there, and it was around U.S. policy around Gaza. from Ukraine to Gaza, if you could comment on the Harris walls policy. We're going to know a lot more tonight, maybe, in their first sit-down interview. And Vance and Trump, Vance, who said in 2022, I don't really care what happens to Ukraine one way or the other.
Yeah. I mean, what we heard from Vice President Harris in her speech, she didn't talk about foreign policy a lot, but Ukraine and Israel-Palestine, Ukraine and Israel-Palestine were two issues she did touch on. She said that the United States would continue to support Ukraine's defense against the Russian invasion. She was very clear about that. And on Israel and Palestine, you know, she said the usual things about continuing to support Israel's right to defend itself, but she also lifted up the humanitarian crisis in Gaza and very strongly reiterated support for Palestinians' right to freedom and self-determination. Now, that language was unsatisfying for a lot of people, myself included. I wish she could have leaned into it a bit more, but I do think it's worth noting that this is the first time we've heard that kind of language from a candidate for president from the Democratic Party in their speech, their acceptance speech at the convention. So again, while I expect the uncommitted movement and other allies to continue pushing on this, I think it's worth just noting that. Now, from Vance and Trump, yes, as you said, Trump, as you know, has been kind of a fan of Putin for a long time, doesn't seem to really care about Ukraine. Vance himself has suggested that our support for Ukraine is distracting from the real enemy, which is China. I think that's a pretty consistent approach between Trump and Vance. They see China as the new big enemy and Ukraine as more of a distraction.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us. So much more has to be discussed, but we have to leave it there. Matt Duss, Executive Vice President of the Center for International Policy, speaking to us from Washington, D.C., and Vladimir Slivyak, co-chair of the Russian environmental organization EcoDefense, who won the 2021 Right Livelihood Award, speaking to us from Berlin, Germany. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is currently hiring a camera operator to work during our live TV broadcast. Learn more at democracynow.com.